Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. President Bush says he does not think that newspaper photos of Saddam Hussein dressed only in his underwear will incite violence in the Arab world. The photos appeared in the Sun newspaper in London and the New York Post today. The U.S. military says it is aggressively investigating the leaks of the photographs, which they say could constitute a violation of the Geneva Conventions. But the Sun says the picture and others were leaked by a U.S. military source hoping to, quote, deal a blow to the resistance in Iraq. Meantime, a second controversy continues in London and the U.S. following the leak of a previously secret British intelligence memo. That document says President Bush had decided to oust Saddam Hussein by military action as early as July of 2002, and that intelligence was being bent to suit that policy. Joining us is Julian Borger, Washington correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper. Julian, in addition to the full-page picture of Saddam Hussein, there are others. Can you describe them?
Well, the other primary photo is Saddam sitting in a pink plastic chair doing his laundry over a tub. Another one of toilets and bathroom from his former palace as by way of a comparison, noting that they were trimmed with gold. So one of those before and after shots.
And there's a lot of mocking copy that goes along with the photos. What is the Sun saying about printing those photos? The Abu Ghraib photos, for instance, exposed abuses. These seem to just expose, literally, Saddam Hussein.
That's right. And as you said, they say they got them from U.S. military sources who handed them over in the hope of dealing a body blow to the resistance in Iraq, they say. They claim their source said, Saddam is not a Superman or God. He's now just an aging and humble old man. So I suppose they're presenting this as doing the bidding of the U.S. military, demythologizing Saddam Hussein in an attempt to undermine the insurgency. But as you point out, the military here, the Pentagon say they had nothing to do with it, and they're investigating aggressively who did leak these photographs.
Well, of course, there was huge reaction after Newsweek printed an item about abuse of the Quran, so there is concern that there will be reaction to these photos. But in the meantime, I want to move to this one secret British memo printed May 1st by the Sunday Times in London. It provides evidence that President Bush, 8 months before the invasion of Iraq, planned to topple Saddam Hussein by military means. What are some of the points of that memo?
Well, this was a memo written by someone called Matthew Rycroft, who was a foreign affairs advisor to the Prime Minister. And it was a meeting of the National Security Cabinet. And Sir Richard Dearlove was there, who's the head of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service. And he was talking about a trip to Washington he'd made, and he'd come back with the impression that this is in July 2002, that the decision had been pretty much made in the Bush administration to oust Saddam Hussein. And the really telling line here was the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. Mm. Up to now, of course, it's the CIA that has really carried the can over this, and that the White House pretty much got off scot-free in terms of allegations that they had deliberately shaped the intelligence. This points very much in that direction.
The memo also apparently quotes Jack Straw as saying that the case against Saddam Hussein is thin because Hussein wasn't threatening his neighbors and that his alleged nuclear capacity was less than that of Libya, North Korea, or Iran.
Yeah, it really puts a different complexion on Jack Straw, who was one of the more aggressive defenders of the government's Iraq policy. You have him very reluctant and very concerned about the case against Saddam. And it does seem as though he just fell into line and followed the policy as a loyal cabinet secretary.
Well, now 89 Democratic congressmen have sent a letter to the White House saying that the memo, quote, raises troubling new questions regarding the legal justifications for the war as well as the integrity of your own administration. This addressed to President Bush. Has there been a response?
The whole attitude of the White House from Karl Rove, really, downwards, is that these matters were resolved in the elections last year and therefore don't have to be revisited. I believe that may have played a role in the very belated coverage that this memo has received in the American press. There's also a sense that this was something that was debated to an end last year at the elections.
Well, and we're hearing from a lot of our listeners that that enrages them. And Julian Borger, I'm wondering your point of view. Has there been an odd, muted response to this memo?
Yeah, I thought it was very strange because it is quite an explosive memo. The Downing Street never denied its veracity and authenticity. So it was remarkable that it wasn't picked up more quickly in the U.S. press. And I think there has been, to some extent, a write-in campaign by American readers that has forced some kind of coverage. And maybe this is one of those things that is a slow burner, that it will gather significance and gather momentum sometime after the initial story broke.
Julian Borger, Washington correspondent for London's Guardian newspaper. Julian, thank you.
Pleasure.
The Eye of the Tiger as cell phone ringtone. And when you answer, you can also now log on and find the nearest clean bathroom, replay a touchdown, or take care of your imaginary pet. 93 million people subscribe to NeoPets, an online fake pet site, that's now available on your cell phone, where you can also take pictures, watch TV, and meet singles. There are 1.5 billion cell phones worldwide, 690 million sold last year. That's six times the number of laptops and PCs. And wireless companies are turning the cell phone into a digital Swiss Army knife. Well, joining us to talk about the latest innovations and the way that cell phone technology is affecting the business world is Bruce Upbin, senior editor at Forbes magazine. Bruce, was there one advance that pushed cell phones over the top, or many?
I think it's been more gradual than sudden. I think it's the combination of bigger color screens, faster networks, longer phone battery times, and better sound. Sound is often underappreciated, but phones now have multiphonic and stereo sound, and that makes for a better experience.
Right. And I'm imagining, too, some entrepreneurs walking around noticing that every single person they saw had a cell phone to their ear and thinking, all of those people, let's think of more things for them to do with that cell phone.
Well, there used to be a lot of attention focused on those PDAs, you know, palms and whatnot, but people realized that the device that no one would ever leave their home without is not the palm, but it's the cell phone, and everyone has it with them. It's got that big screen, so it's becoming, as an investment vehicle, a software platform. It's becoming the thing. It's the fourth screen if you're a broadcaster. If you're a venture capitalist, it's one of the few games in town.
Fourth screen, after TV,
movies, and computer.
And computer, right. Well, let's just briefly tap into some of the digital services you can subscribe to.
Well, usually, you know, the average cell phone bill is around $40 to $60. So these services, they tack on if you want ringtones, unlimited, it could be $5 a month. If you want television service, like the Verizon VCast, it's $15 a month. A lot of things are per time you use it, like a SMS messaging service where you can get telephone numbers and movie times all by sending little short codes to your carrier. They send back, you know, what's playing in your area. Those can cost 25 cents each.
MapQuest can give you directions for about $4 a month. Smart Traffic tells you how the traffic's going in your area. There's Singles Dating.
Match.com, which is big online on PCs, is also Match.com mobile. That's $5 a month, and they don't even bother with all the profiles. They just tell you that you can flirt anywhere, anytime.
and then you can also go out to dinner. Vindigo, $25 a year, gives you restaurant and movie reviews. And as you point out in a separate sidebar to your article, you know, there's always pornography, which is now coming to your cell phone for, what, something like a $10 a month service.
Right, right. And up. It's the Thriller app.
I keep hearing the statements, you know, this is the greatest thing since the Internet bubble. This is going to be bigger than the Internet, you know, on and on. But remember that Internet bubble burst. Mm-hmm. So what is the thought of the staying power of the cell phone?
Well, I'm glad to hear that giddiness is back. So let's not dismiss giddiness for its own sake. It's a good thing. It's a healthy thing for the economy. And the cell phone revolution, such as it is bringing companies back from the dead. But by no means is it the same kind of, it's not going to play out the same way as the Internet bubble, because there just simply aren't as many ridiculous, overly funded companies becoming IPOs. So a lot of these companies are bigger, they've been around longer, and the underpinning for all of it is these large telephone companies that aren't going anywhere, that have a vested interest in making sure this doesn't just blow up in their face.
Well, in fact, give us an idea of some of those. For instance, Sprint, PCS, 8 million of its 26 million subscribers now use some of the data services. Give us a sense of how much usage there is.
Well, like you mentioned Sprint. They're one of the most aggressive at playing out this trend. So 8 million of its 26 million subscribers now use data. They're talking about 300 million photos, which costs $6 a month on average to do, and that's an extra 10% on their tacked on top of their voice bill. Verizon, which is the largest, tied with Singular right around there, 16.5 million wireless data customers out of the 44 million total at the end of last year, and they're spending $1 billion plus a year, double what they spent in 2003, just to get picture messages and ringtone downloads, like 100 million of each of those.
Right. In fact, you quote research firm Instat saying that major U.S. carriers are going to be spending almost $20 billion in 2 to 3 years upgrading to these new networks that are going to support all of these services we've been talking about. Give us some more sense of how big are the investments in this industry.
Well, you mentioned the $20 billion. Qualcomm is investing $800 million just to build a mobile broadcast video network to offer to consumers sometime later this year or next. Siemens, the German telecommunications company, is spending over $100 million on venture startups this year. You see, you know, deals for startups, again, that sell games or sell porn or that sell messaging services, getting $15, $30, and $50 million deals. The last 5 years, has been about $10.5 billion spent on wireless startups.
Well, you're Forbes. What does this mean, that all of this money is being directed towards this, you know, one industry, the cell phone industry?
I think it's great. I think they're recognizing that phones are like computers. I mean, if you rip open a phone, you'll find inside of it a computer that's probably as powerful as the ones in the 80s. Honestly, that's how much technology has changed and miniaturized. And pretty soon we might not find the need to use PCs and to be chained to our desks.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Are other industries sort of moving over some of their investment to cell phones in anticipation?
Well, if you're a broadcaster, let's say, you know, Disney, which owns ABC, you've got to have a wireless play. You need to be in customers' faces. That's why you see Disney launching its own wireless company. They're going to become like a Verizon or a Sprint, but you'll buy a Disney phone and pay Disney $60 a month and make your calls over a Mickey phone. and a lot of the services on there will be Disneyfied. So it's a way to both extend their brand, you know, sell more movie tickets, but also stay in the face of people who are spending less time in front of the television, reading a book, reading magazines, or even listening to the radio.
Nice.
They're staring at their phones. I mean, everyone says go to Japan and Korea for the harbingers of things to come in this country when it comes to wireless. And there, people don't even talk on their phones anymore. They just look at them and do things with them, staring at them. They hold them in front of their faces.
And do not talk to each other.
Right, as little as possible.
Well, I have one of the latest Verizon cell phones here with me. It's the VX8000. I'm amazed at some of the sophisticated games on it. But it has a game based on the Disney movie The Incredibles. You were just talking about that kind of branching out. So let's just hear a little bit of it and see a little bit of it. Here we go. Okay. Oh, there's the dad. This big flexing of muscles. Okay. So, boy, the animation on that is great.
Mm-hmm.
That's Bruce Uppin, senior editor at Forbes magazine. Tell you what, I know some of you listening are probably saying, oh, great, more noise from cell phones to annoy me. But there are parents using cell phones to soothe babies. And we're going to talk to the producers of the show 24, making a version of that show for the cell phone. There's more ahead here and now. Young, it's here and now, and we've been talking about the latest innovations in cell phones, whole companies rising from the rubble of the internet collapse to produce software for phones, along with entrepreneurs coming up with their own ideas. Our guest is Bruce Uppin, senior editor at Forbes magazine. Bruce, some of the hottest technologies now are shows that are produced just for your cell phone. But first I want to ask you, do these little movies and TV shows translate the way they would on a television screen?
Not really. I mean, the quality of the TV on cell phones is pretty crummy. You'd turn off your TV in a second if it looked like that. And the talent is not going to be that great. You're not going to get Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise on there. But, you know, what's more interesting about phones is things that people hadn't thought you could do on a phone. And I'm thinking of something like Vindigo's Moviegoer, where when you think in your head, oh, my God, I want to rent that movie next time I'm home, but you always go to the go to the store and you forgot which one it is, or you're at the store and they're out of Kinsey, and you say, "Honey, I'm at the store. What else do you want to get?" This is a program that will allow you to store all your preferences for movies and things you to remind yourself to get. And then when you're at the store, you flip open the phone and go to the moviegoer program, and it tells you.
But still, even though the technology isn't quite there yet for these kind of moving images on the cell phone, as you point out, there is the so-called television. People launching television shows and movies. Verizon launching its VCast, dozens of channels, 60-second mobisodes, original content for cell phones. And in addition, there are already 300,000 Sprint and Singular Wireless subscribers who can watch MOBA TV. What's that?
Mm-hmm. It's a service. It's like digital cable. You have news, sports, weather, and some mild entertainment, and it can change the channel, and you download a show. It's not terribly great right now, but the networks are getting better, and the chips inside those phones are getting better, and the batteries have to get better. I mean, if you're going to watch TV all day on your cell phone, you'll never get a chance to talk because your battery will be dead.
Well, we're going to talk to the producers of one of these shows in a moment, but how big an impact did digital photography have on what we're seeing now?
For most people, that's the be-all and end-all of their phone. It allows them to take pictures and send them to their friends from anywhere. And camera phones now outsell all other phones, and they outsell film and digital cameras combined.
Wow. And we know that camera companies, as all companies are reacting to cell phones. But it reminds me, too, a cell phone picture is not as good as a camera photo. Do you sacrifice quality in just about any way you might use a cell phone?
If you want a great music listening experience, you get an iPod. If you want to take a great picture, use your camera. What the phone offers is convenience, instantaneous usage, mobility, and intimacy. And everything is slightly different. I mean, the kind of things you could do with a phone, an iPod cannot do. If you want to quiet a crying baby at the dinner table at a restaurant, you hand them a phone, and there's a game called Babysitter that has little elephants, you know, puffing smoke out of their trunks, and the baby's quiet all of a sudden.
This is from Digital Chocolate in San Mateo, California.
If you want to hook up with friends and find out where they are in the neighborhood, you use Dodgeball, which is this wireless service that Google just bought. And it tells you who's nearby of your friends and friends of friends, so you can maybe make a blind date with a friend of a friend. It's a different world. I'm saying it's not a high-quality world necessarily. You have to take it for what it is.
It's a convenient world.
Yeah.
Bruce Upbin, senior editor at Forbes magazine, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure.
Well, there are a number of programs available for cell phones. Here's a clip we've downloaded from Fox's The Simple Life. It's an abbreviated cell phone version of the Fox television show with debutantes Paris Hilton and Nicole Richie. In this mobisode, they take care of a polar bear at the zoo.
And, oops, it looks so nice.
I know. I, like, don't believe it'll bite you.
Oh, yeah, they're terrible carnivores. They would eat you in a minute.
It's so cute.
Well, no one said it was high art, but some see it as the emergence of a new medium. Instead of repackaging current television shows, people actually producing original movies and programs for cell phones. And joining us now, Lucy Hood, Senior Vice President of Content and Marketing for News Corp. She oversees the Fox Wireless Entertainment Group. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Also, Eric Young of Spark Hill. His company produces one of the mobisodes, or mobile episodes, that can be downloaded on Verizon phones. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Robin.
And Lucy, I want to start with you. How big of an investment is your company making in this field?
Let's just say that creating a 60-second episode is considerably less expensive than a 60-minute episode.
Well, let's look at some dollars and cents. There's a company that it's called Fun Little Movies, and they say that minute-long films cost $2,000 to $8,000 a minute to produce, as opposed to $1 million a minute for a big-budget film. So, Lucy, that's probably very appealing.
Well, it's obviously less expensive, and since consumers are paying 99 cents to download The Simple Life, it's a relevant cost.
And Eric Young, you executive produce one of the mobisodes called 24 Conspiracy, a spinoff of Fox's popular 24 television series, but without the stars.
That's correct.
And in 24, to those who haven't seen this, you know, very popular program, these are one-hour episodes. They take you through 24 hours in the life of the character. The mobisode's just 1 minute?
24 one-minute episodes.
And what's it like putting together a one-minute show?
It's great. It's very much like shooting a television show, but you just have a lot less time to get the story across.
Well, I have one here on the cell phone. Okay, you've got two characters talking very seriously in front of a computer in a room. A camera cutting from one to the other. Very intense. Music coming up underneath. Well, I have to tell you, Eric, the quality of this, I mean, there's a technical quality that is a little bit jumpy, but the production quality is very good.
We actually set out to replicate the look of the television show, but we used other tools to accomplish it. For example, we used small digital cameras versus large 35-millimeter film cameras, but replicated and tried to imitate as best as possible the actual lighting of the television series.
Well, Lucy Hood, again, a senior VP of News Corp, which is overseeing Fox Wireless Entertainment Group, which is producing these little mobisodes. What's the thinking of the company overall? Are you thinking you're investing in a future that might replace, you know, television programming? Or are you thinking that you're investing in a trend that, you know, much like a lot of the speculation about the internet, that bubble burst, do you think this bubble's going to burst as well?
No. There are 1.6 billion mobile handsets in the world, and approximately 100 million will have video by the end of the decade. So we think this is a growing trend, although we think it's a completely new medium. And we're designing the format of the mobisode and the content of them specifically for mobile viewing.
Lucy Hood, Senior Vice President of Content and Marketing for News Corp. Eric Young of Spark Hill, whose company produces the mobisode 24 Conspiracy. Thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
And this note, next week on Here and Now, we'll follow the filibuster story in the Senate. We'll see if anyone blinks. And newly discovered Mendelssohn. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Traumatic brain injury, or TBI, has been called the signature wound of the Iraq War. It's estimated that a quarter of the wounded soldiers have sustained TBIs. One of them is Staff Sergeant Jason Pepper. And yes, everyone points out he is Sergeant Pepper. And he is a 28-year-old who lost his sight and suffered other severe injuries when an improvised explosive device blew up less than a meter from him. Jason is one of the many patients who's been treated at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. He and others were profiled in an article in this week's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. Reporter Rachel Gottbaum spoke to Pepper about his injuries for the journal. Here's an excerpt.
Actually, it was a year ago, May 7th, we were on a patrol through Karbala when we got ambushed. The lead vehicle got hit with an RPG, which is a rocket-propelled grenade. And then when I looked behind us, there was another RPG that was coming towards us. When I saw that RPG, I jumped across to the other side of the vehicle, pushed them out of the way, thinking it was going to hit us. And as soon as I pushed them out of the way and set to return fire, that's when an IED, improvised explosive device, was in a tree, had been detonated. The blast happened, and then everything became dark. I felt myself get thrown back and then landed on the floor. The only thing I could hear at the first point in time was this piercing ringing noise. It was really odd. It was pitch black. And all I could hear was gunfire around. I could hear everybody in the squad returning fire. I could feel them moving me around, but my body was in such shock, I couldn't say anything. And the only thoughts in my head was, what about my wife and daughter? It's really vivid. I mean, I remember it very, very clearly. And then next thing you know, I remember feeling the rotor wash from the helicopter. And then I woke up sometime later, I'm guessing 15-plus hours later, in a CAS unit in Baghdad.
So when did you find out about your injuries?
I found out about my injuries, I'd say probably a couple hours after I woke up from the first surgery. I think it might have been a day or two before it actually set in. The doctor and the surgeons that worked on me, plus the chaplain, he told me, sorry, there was nothing we could do to save your eyes. So we had to basically remove what was left. At first, I didn't want to believe it, and the only thoughts that I could come back was my wife and daughter again. The chaplain used his cell phone that he had down there, and I was able to call my wife, Heather, and let her know basically I was all right. You know, I was trying to joke around with her to make it as comfortable as possible. You know, I was told her that, you know, I could still see my digits, meaning my fingers and my arms. Basically, to me, I thought everything was okay. Even though they told me what my injuries were, I still didn't want to believe it. I mean, I had patches over my eyes that I didn't know at first. I guess I was telling myself that I could see and not wanting to believe that I couldn't.
So what kind of brain injuries have they told you have sustained?
They told me I had a skull fracture sustained in the blast. I also had a subdural hematoma and a bruised brain. If I didn't have that skull fracture, my brain injury would have been a lot worse. But since I had that skull fracture, the pressure from the subdural hematoma actually had a place to expand and release. Right now, I have a memory problem. It's like the wires got crossed somewhere. from the TBI that they said I have an attention disorder. They said my brain is processing information different. If I don't repeat something to myself, say 50 or 100 times, it's like I instantly lose it. And then all of a sudden it'll come back to me 3-4 days later. And it's just like I'll tell Heather, oh, hey, look, I just remembered this one thing. And then all of a sudden she's like, well, they told us that 3 or 4 days ago. To me, it's new in my head, but really it's a couple days old unless I keep repeating it to myself.
So what's been the most challenging thing about rehab?
Deciphering night and day. It's really hard because even though I have a talking watch, I don't wear it all the time. So if I wake up in the middle of the night, it's, well, is it 9 o'clock in the morning? Is it 1 o'clock in the afternoon? Is it still 3 o'clock in the morning? Sense of time is one of the hardest things to actually overcome.
So what do you think about the military medical system?
Like anything, they have their ups, their downs. I couldn't ask for anything better as far as my hand surgeons, my eye surgeons, everybody who's worked on me. I have nothing but great things to say about them. I mean, they've done miracles, putting my arm, putting my hand back together, making prosthetic eyes for me, doing skin grafts to create lower eyelids. I mean, everything was really great. The only thing I foresee lacking is nursing staff. They don't put any care behind it. If they're a military nurse, it's, well, I'm an officer, you're lower enlisted, I don't care what your injuries are, you still better respect my authority. There's just no compassion behind what they do. They could definitely work on their compassion. We used to put signs on my door, and even the hospital would put signs on their door. Blind patient, please announce yourself when entering. Well, they just walk in and just go about their business. I remember one time distinctly, I was sleeping. They walked in, came right in the room instead of waking me up. They went straight for my arm and drew blood. They woke me up, actually sticking me with a needle.
What are you hoping to get from the blind rehab program?
Independence. That's the big thing. Basically, the independent life skills that I need to continue on with life, and maybe the skills to be able to get a job afterwards.
Do you have plans for the future? Have you thought about what you want to be doing?
What I want to do and what I can do are two different things. My ultimate goal actually is to be the first blind firefighter. I was a volunteer firefighter before the military, and my heart right now is in two places. It's either the military or firefighting. Well, since I can't stay active duty in the military, firefighting is my next goal. I don't mean to be a dispatcher or I actually want to be a firefighter running into burning buildings while people are running out. You know, as we like to say, to be a smoke eater. I don't know if actually being a firefighter will be an option, but I'm going to sure try to make it an option.
So how has this experience affected you? Have you changed?
There are significant changes that other people have told me and plus that I've noticed. My emotions are, it's like a roller coaster. I'll be fine. A couple hours later, I might be depressed. Little things aggravate me more. You know, Heather could say something or somebody else around me could say something and it just really makes me mad. And then 5-10 minutes later, I might be fine. Apparently, they say with TBIs and stuff like that, your emotions, anger, anxiousness, it's just all different things that I never had before.
Do you sometimes think, who is this person?
Sometimes I don't know it's me. I mean, my whole world is different. I guess the easiest way to explain it is what Heather said a couple weeks ago, is I'm trapped in my own head. Basically, I can't get outside the puzzle box. I'm trying to think outside my head, and I'm trying to be outside my head. But due to the fact that I'm blind, all I can is be in my head. All I have now is memories. I mean, there's so many things that I want, you know, being able to see my daughter, all the cute little faces, and the silly things that she does, I can only imagine it. I'll never be able to accept the fact that she's growing up and has changed. The way I'll always see her is this 19-month-old girl that I left behind.
That's Sergeant Jason Pepper, who's been undergoing treatment for the past year at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington. He spoke with reporter Rachel Gottbaum for the New England Journal of Medicine. And still to come, where did rap come from? We'll hear the opinions of some artists in South Africa. You're listening to Here and Now. We'll be right back. This week, while senators lobbed verbal grenades in the debate over judicial nominees, a judge pleaded for less harsh rhetoric. Federal Judge Joan Lefkow of Chicago, whose mother and husband were shot and killed in her home by a former defendant in her courtroom, said violent words lead to violent deeds. Well, here are some of the words used this week in the Senate: detonated, destroyed, crushed, chaos, anarchy, kill, and, by Majority Leader Bill Frist, assassinate.
The issue is not cloture votes per se. It's the partisan leadership-led use of cloture vote to kill, to defeat, to assassinate these nominees.
Later, Democratic Senator Richard Durbin condemned the words.
Those words should be taken from this record. Those words go too far.
Well, joining us on the line from Washington is Deborah Tannen. She teaches linguistics at Georgetown University. And Deborah, in 1999, you also wrote one of your many books called The Argument Culture. You looked at this question of violent language. Is there anything really different about these debates, or has it been ever thus?
There has always been a lot of opposition and strong rhetoric, but the specific warlike language has been ratcheted up.
Judge Lefkow, as we said, lost family members recently. On Wednesday, she testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about the language politicians used during the Terri Schiavo debate, when judges, mostly Republican, agreed with Schiavo's husband's wishes that she be taken off food and water. Lefkow quoted televangelist Pat Robertson's response. He said that federal judges pose a threat probably more serious than a few bearded terrorists who fly into buildings. Senator Tom Coburn's chief of staff was quoted as saying of judges, "I'm a radical. I don't want to impeach judges. I want to impale them." And finally, Tom DeLay said judges who got in the way of efforts to keep the feeding tube in Ms. Schiavo would one day have to answer for their behavior. Lefkow said that language was endangering the lives of judges.
I would agree with her. It's blood-curdling to hear words like assassinate and kill when people are, in fact, being assassinated and killed. There's an argument that even more toned-down rhetoric can set a tone that can encourage people to violent acts. If you talk about people as if they were so evil that they deserve the worst, and then somebody goes and acts on that, you can trace that sometimes to the language. Of course, it's intended metaphorically, but there are always many people who don't see the line between the metaphor, assassinate, and the act, assassinate.
But is it ratcheted up on both sides of the aisle? And is this something that politicians do around the world?
It has been more in recent years on the Republican side. And I believe that part of that reason is that Democrats have believed for a long time that because their policies are good for a majority of the people, they believe it, and I believe it too, all they have to do is get the information out. I think Republicans have been very adept at realizing that politics, like everything else these days, is very much a matter of advertising and public relations. So just as if you were advertising for soap, you get a good line, you repeat it over and over, it gets in people's minds, and if they used language that was very oppositional and said terrible things attacking their opponent, that would be the bit that would be put on the news. And look, here we are talking about it right now.
Right. And how about the worldwide aspect? Do Americans do this more than other cultures?
Yes. In fact, the general tendency to use opposition as the path to truth is more common in the West, especially common among Americans, and really not common at all in many of the Asian countries, as an example.
You've pointed out that, for instance, the Japanese standard image when they have discussions isn't war, but perhaps the human body.
Yes. I had a student who studied the Japanese talk shows compared to the American ones, and one good example she had come up with where they were discussing the economy in terms of medical conditions. So one said, well, it's not very serious. It's just a digestive problem, and the economy needs to just take it easy for a short time, and it'll all come right. And the other one said, no, 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 it's a circulatory problem, and the heart is involved. you would be surprised to hear that on an American show.
Deborah Tannen teaches linguistics at Georgetown University, also is the author most recently of I Only Say This Because I Love You. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you. A pleasure to talk to you.
Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. That's Russian pianist Olga Kern competing in the Olympics of Classical Music, the Van Cliburn International Piano Competition, where she was co-winner of the gold medal in 2001. Held every 4 years in Fort Worth, Texas, the Van Cliburn Competition was founded to honor the hometown hero who won the first Tchaikovsky International Piano Competition in Moscow in 1958. This year's Van Cliburn Competition begins today and runs through June 5th. 35 competitors from 13 countries will vie for the coveted prizes. The gold medal winner will receive more than $500,000 in cash and, more important, concert performance fees. Winning the Van Cliburn can give previously unknown artists instant name recognition and the chance to perform with orchestras around the country. Van Cliburn won the Tchaikovsky in Moscow in 1958. He was given a ticker tape parade back in the U.S. It was a matter of national pride that an American would shine on the international stage. Well, fast forward to the present, when many believe that in the area of pop culture, at least, America is colonizing the world. Take South Africa, for example. WBUR reporter Sean Cole was recently there gathering tape for a story on urban music. During the trip, he found himself at a music festival south of Johannesburg, talking to a hip-hop collective called Moon, that's M-U-N Productions, members who one day hope to be the South African equivalent of our Jay-Z or 50 Cent. They told him rap and hip-hop have really taken hold where they live, but before we listen, a quick advisory. There are a couple uses of strong language.
Of course, hip-hop started sprouting up in other countries long ago, but in a lot of those places, it's kind of an awkward fit, like kids are just playing dress-up, literally and figuratively. In South Africa, though, the hip-hop scene is so authentic that it's even hard to tell who's influencing who sometimes, who invented which handshake, or, more to the point, who first started putting rhythm to words.
In terms of Western influence and whatnot, I figure it's hip-hop started in Africa anyway.
This is one of the guys from Moon Productions. He goes by the name Lef Lef.
So what these guys are doing in the U.S. is exactly what we used to do centuries ago.
We're getting it back, man.
Yeah.
We're taking it back.
That's all we're doing. We're just taking it back.
Lyric Invader.
You're Lyric Invader.
Lyric Invader. It's basically, we started listening to international rappers, you know, hip-hop artists, and we thought we could do something similar to them.
And so which artists in particular were you hearing?
Funkmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
Yeah.
Run DMC. This is all the old school hip hop.
Yeah,
that's what influenced us
LL
to get into
cool
the game.
LL Cool J.
Back in the day. Yeah. Back in the day, though.
Some of PM. NWA as well.
KRS-One. You can't forget the teacher, man.
No doubt. Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Obviously. I feel like I'm at home talking about music. I feel like I'm standing in Boston. Yeah. Like, yeah, KRS-One. No doubt.
But doesn't matter where they. Everybody knows that they took the stuff from Africa, so it comes all the way from Black Mambazo to flipping.
Look, I speak Sotho.
This is Chris, another Moon Productions artist.
And we have people that go up to the mountains and they do this rhythmic thing, you know? And I've always thought hip hop has lived in there as well, in the bushes. And you'd hear them saying, you know? That's hip-hop.
It's rap.
And a few of the rhymes on the Moon Productions debut CD are actually in African languages. I asked Lef Lef if he thought rap in Zulu and Sotho would make it in the international market. He said it would, but that he prefers to rap in English. So I asked him for a sample.
You want to get a sample? Okay, cool. Ladies is pushing like they delivering babies now. Fellas is rushing like they busting a quick nut. They all want to get up in the spot and stomp. Dog niggas chilling at the back. All the mommies got Chris Styles back. Chris is spilling. Me, I'm killing. Ripping this mic to shreds. I'm getting loco. I shot ya. Call Popo. I be in Alcapoco. With girls soaked in Chanel's cocoa. Yeah, I'll poke yo. Style. Whoever thought Lift Man would never make it, I take the game and bake it. Well y'all fake it. That's just a little sample.
That sounds like it, as solid as any, you know, rapper that I've heard in the States. I mean, like, I don't even know if I would know you were from Africa in that particular one.
No, but honestly, that's the kind of response I'm hoping to get. Uh-huh. Because we want to go international. We don't want to stay in. We want to hit the whole of Africa.
The whole world.
Everywhere, you know what I mean? Make the whole world just, you know, get on their knees and say, God, damn, Africa's banging. You know, clear, that's all we want.
The park, yeah, like King, you know? Sacramento, Mississippi, hey,
New Jersey, name it.
Hey, don't forget it. Don't forget it. Manchester United, you know what I mean? Yeah, all the guys in England.
Don't forget Manchester, New Hampshire.
Yeah. New Hampshire, that's
the one. Southampton, Lancaster, and stuff.
MUN stands for Music Uniting New Hampshire. No, I'm kidding. MUN stands for Music Uniting Nations. The main idea is to try to defeat the xenophobia between people of different African countries, which is really plaguing the continent these days, by getting rappers from all over Africa to work together on the same project. But where the group's desire to go international is concerned, Chris says the acronym stands for something else.
You know, we're gonna make universal negotiation. You know, that's MUN. Making universal negotiation, because I think what the United States has done is that they've made a universal negotiation with us to say, guys, this is what we're doing, listen to it, and that's why we know the words. So MUN Productions is going to be the first people that are going to go out there, and you're going to have 50 Cent saying, hey, fair to Shapuze, you know what I mean? How you doing? You know? And we're going to do that.
I dream. I sleep, and I have dreams of Jay-Z saying, hola, we ter, zkipan, baba. You know what I'm saying? Like, that'll be so nice, you know?
What does that mean?
Hola, we ter, that means, what's up?
What's up kind of thing, you know?
Zkipan means how you doing.
The funny thing is that MUN Productions, and actually a lot of the artists I talk to in South Africa, seem to think that this cultural exchange might finally come about through me. It's like I was this envoy for my entire country. Over and over again, they'd say, I just hope somebody over there hears this and gets in touch with us. Or, as Lif Lif put it,
in Africa, we've got a lot to say. That's all I gotta say. And I'm gonna finish with you right now by saying, we've got a lot to say, and it's up to you guys to listen to us. That's all. And it's up to you guys to buy CDs. It's up to you guys to, you know, at least get a flavor of something different, man. You know, aren't you tired of the 50 Cent?
Me specifically, yes, I am tired of the 50 Cent. No disrespect, but if I have to hear, I'll take you to the candy shop, I'll let you lick the lollipop, one more time, I'm gonna lose my mind. Luckily, I brought a lot of CDs back with me from South Africa. Here's a track off MUN Productions' new compilation disc, The Takeoff, Volume 1. The song's called Backstabber. Backstabber, mm-hmm. Backstabber, who claim that you and Zanga come on Bali when you're in a backstabber, backstabber,
Chuka Abba, Cindy Wamun Zanga, backstabber. In South Africa, WBUR reporter and now DJ Sean Cole spoke with Lif Lif, Chris, Robert, Lyric Invader, and Toxic Dilemma, members of MUN Productions. Again, their debut CD is called The Takeoff, Volume 1. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Stefano Katsonis, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, Emiko Tamagawa, and Karen Miller-Metzen. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deborah Becker. Our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now. Chani chomo chitila choncho Ukamba pali wanza konguyo kwa wakwa nkonto Baja umauza na wanakone lamo. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.